Numbers, chapters 20 and 21. The 11th talk in a series on Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on April 29, 2019 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 11. Numbers 20 and 21 accompanies this talk.
We're in Numbers chapter 20. We've got some very significant events in these next two chapters, a couple of very interesting and significant passages. We have the deaths of Miriam, the death of Aaron, and then we've got the sin of Moses that we're going to have to talk about. Now, remember that the context of this is that just a couple chapters earlier, we had Korah's rebellion, which is a challenge to the leadership of both Aaron and Moses, but in particular, Aaron. And God dealt with that rebellion by swallowing up the rebels. The earth opened up and swallowed up the rebels. But then the next day, the people complained that that Moses had killed all those people, and so God then dealt with them as well with a plague. And then God had this contest that he devised, in which all of the tribes of Israel were supposed to bring a staff. The leader of each tribe was supposed to bring the staff with their names written on it, and Aaron's staff, it bloomed into an almond branch with leaves and buds and almonds that appeared on the branch overnight, attesting to the God-given authority that Aaron had. So those are the events that preceded the chapter that we're looking at now, chapter 20. Verse 1, then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. So they're marching through the desert. They come to the wilderness of Zin. That's not real helpful. Nobody knows where the wilderness of Zin is. It's assumed that it is in the vicinity of Kadesh Barnea, which has been mentioned before and will be mentioned again. They say that it says that that's in the first month. It doesn't say in the first month of what. It would be nice if they had first month of what. But it must be the first month of something significant. And if we put the pieces together, it would appear that this is the first month of the 40th year. So this is the first month of the last year that they are in the wilderness. So this is at the very end of their wanderings in the desert, and they're starting their trek up the east side of the Dead Sea and the Jordan River, and eventually will enter into the Promised Land from the east. Miriam died there and was buried. This is a strange sentence, because Miriam's death gets mentioned, but nothing more about the death gets mentioned. It's just that she died. And I'll talk about the significance of that later. Verse 2, and there was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. I'm going to stop there. I need to go someplace else before we read this. What we're going to read about is Moses bringing water out of a rock. Moses has already brought water out of a rock. That was in Exodus 17. The incident in Exodus 17 is quite similar to this incident. There are several incidents that are talked about as the Israelites are moving from the Red Sea to Mount Sinai that have very similar counterparts in the trip from Mount Sinai to the Promised Land. And as I've said before, I think that we are encouraged to compare the two. I think that the whole account is encouraging us to look at this as a before and an after. And this incident in particular, I think we are encouraged to look at the one in Exodus 17 and compare it to the one in Numbers 20, because there are a lot of similarities. The overall story is very similar, but there are some significant differences, and I think that those significant differences help us to understand what's going on in Numbers chapter 20. So let's read Exodus 17, 1 through 7, then we'll come back to Numbers 20. So if you will recall, this was happening just a week or two after they had left Egypt. And they had been, a few days earlier, they had been out of water. And they came upon some water, but it was bitter. But God turned it sweet so that they could drink it. A little bit after that, they were complaining about not having meat. And God provided quail. And he also began to provide the manna on a daily basis. So those things have all occurred. And then, a few days after those things have occurred, we have this event in Exodus 17. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Okay, that's the account in Exodus 17. So keep that in mind as I read what happens in Numbers 20, beginning with verse 2. "And there was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. The people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, 'If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? And why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink.' Then Moses and Aaron came in from the presence of the assembly to the doorway of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Take the rod and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beasts drink. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, "Listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. And water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. I'm going to comment on the various differences that I see. There are more differences than I have listed here, but these are the ones I think are the most significant. In this passage, it typically uses the words "for the congregation," as opposed to the passage in Exodus 17 where it says "for the people." The term "for the congregation" or congregation appears five times in these 13 verses. I'm not sure what to do with that difference. I noticed in the account of the Korah rebellion, it frequently talks to the congregation. So it's more likely to use the word congregation or assembly rather than the people, which is the term that was used in Exodus. Now, it could be that there is no significance there. It's just a variation. But my suspicion is that it is significant, and that we are seeing that the author is underscoring the fact that this mob that left Egypt is coalescing into a community, a group, in which there are shared experiences, values, etc., and therefore referring to it as a congregation rather than just the people. They say, when there's no water, they say, "We wish we had died with our brothers." I assume that that's a reference to Korah's rebellion. And if that's true, then what they're saying is, "I wish we had been swallowed up in the earth with Korah and the other rebels rather than to experience what we are experiencing now," which is quite a thing to say, given that the swallowing up of Korah's people by the earth was a punishment for their blasphemy, and for them to say, "I would rather have had that fate than the fate that I have," is quite a statement. It says in this passage, "Why did you bring us out here to die?" And it says, "us and our beasts." In Exodus 17, it was "us and our children and the beasts." Now again, it could be insignificant. The difference could be insignificant, just different wording, but no significant difference in meaning. But it's possible that they've left out their children because they're all going to die and they're losing their hope. To a significant degree, they've lost their hope. There is no real future. I don't know that that's the case, but something along those lines might be what's indicated here. Then notice what they're complaining about. They're complaining, saying, why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? And why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink. Why'd you bring us out of Egypt? We've heard that many times. It's as if things were great in Egypt. And this is a wretched place, and there's no grain, figs, vines, or pomegranates. And there's no water. The water is an afterthought in this. It's the variety of foods that they enjoyed in Egypt that they're underscoring as being absent here. And notice that there is no incident here that has provoked this. It's just in a place where they're saying there is no water. So it seems to be more of an occasion for complaint rather than a real crisis that they're facing. Moses and Aaron respond to this by falling on their faces. It doesn't have any reaction like that in Exodus 17. We have seen them fall on their faces. This is the fifth time now, and it's all been in the last few chapters. And each time it seems to be that they fall on their faces when they are presented with blasphemous behavior or attitudes. In this section in Numbers, then, God tells Moses what he is supposed to do in response to this. And then it goes on with a section to tell us what he actually did, and there's some deviation between the two. In Exodus 17, God tells Moses what to do, and then it just says, and he did it. One of the things that he's supposed to do in Numbers is he's supposed to assemble the congregation. In Exodus 17, it doesn't tell him to assemble the congregation. It tells him to get the elders and take the elders to the place where the rock was. So it's only the elders that are seeing this firsthand in Exodus 17, but in Numbers 20, it's the whole people that are witnessing this. And we've noticed three or four times that God has gone out of his way since the Korah rebellion to display his power directly to the people without any intermediary. Instead of displaying his power and to a few and having them tell the congregation, he's having the whole congregation see it for themselves. In his instructions in Numbers, Moses is supposed to take the staff from the tabernacle. In Exodus 17, he was supposed to take the staff that he held in his hand when he struck the waters of the Nile to turn it to blood. So it's apparently two different staffs. I suspect that both staffs are symbolic of something. I'm not certain that I know what they are supposed to symbolize. The staff that Moses used when he struck the Nile, that seems to be associated with displays of God's power. That staff seems to be symbolic of God's overt acts of power. Aaron's staff, it's harder for me to figure out what that is symbolizing. That was, God used that staff to show the power and authority invested in Aaron. And I presume, and the priesthood. So that could be the significance of it. But that staff also, it was a dead piece of wood that sprouted leaves and blossoms and almonds. And so out of something that was absolutely dead came life. So that staff could symbolize the emergence of life out of death. I'm not sure exactly. Maybe it's some other symbolism. I'm not sure exactly what they symbolize, but I feel quite confident that they symbolize two different things, and that what God told Moses to do, both in Exodus 17 and here in Numbers 20, is building on the symbolism of that staff. of the staff that was used in each case. In Numbers 20, Moses speaks to the people and he says, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water?" And there are two things of significance there. One is addressing them as rebels. He has never done that before. Moses has not. They are rebels. It's not like he's lying, but he has never expressed it that way to them. And then he says, "Shall we bring forth water from this rock?" Suggesting that Moses and God are partners in bringing forth this water, that they are potentially even equal partners in this project. I think with these two things, the calling them rebels and then talking about we will bring forth this water, it appears to me that what Moses is doing here is something that he has never done before in any of the other accounts. In all of the other accounts, Moses has quickly identified with the people. He was a defender of the people. He didn't defend their actions, but he stood up for them insofar as he saw them as being in need of God's mercy and appealed for God's mercy. In this occasion, there's no suggestion that he's doing that. He is calling them rebels. He's not identifying with them now. He had been identifying with them previously. But he seems to be identifying with God and even with God's power here. Then he struck the rock two times. In Exodus 17, he was supposed to strike the rock one time, which he did. Here he's not supposed to strike it at all, but he strikes it two times. And it says that he lifted his hand. He did it with an upraised hand. That phrase, an upraised hand, is used a number of times in the Old Testament, and it can be both a positive thing and a negative thing. To sin with an upraised hand is to be defiant. And that's the worst kind of sin, is a sin with an upraised hand. But there are other times when an upraised hand seems to suggest with a show of power, and it can be in a positive way. In fact, there's a verse that says that the Israelites left Egypt with an upraised hand. So it was with a show of God's power that they left Egypt. So I think it's significant here that it says that he lifted his hand when he struck the rock two times. And my suspicion is that what it's suggesting here is that God took it upon himself to display God's power to the people. Then water came out abundantly. That's true of Exodus 17. It's true here. I just pointed out because I think it's interesting that even though Moses sinned in this incident, that did not stop God from bringing water out of the rock. Just because Moses didn't do it the way God told him to do it, God still brought water out of the rock. Then Moses and Aaron are condemned for what they had done. God says, "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." So Moses and Aaron, and both Moses and Aaron are condemned for this, even though there's no explicit mention of Aaron's actions in this. They have not believed God. They have not treated God as holy. And they did not humbly obey. and therefore they were told that they would not enter into the promised land. Okay, so what happened in this incident? There are several things that I want to comment on. The first thing is, it would appear that the people were still being influenced by the theological beliefs that had been proclaimed by Korah in relationship to Korah's rebellion. And they look wistfully back at that, in a sense, that they wish they had died when their brothers died and were swallowed by the earth. And they're still complaining about being away from Egypt, which they have done consistently throughout these passages as they make their way through the wilderness. Moses, if you'll remember from 2 weeks ago, I think Moses was thinking that the rebellions would end. Remember in chapter 17, verse 5, this is when God is setting up the test where the staffs will be laid out and there'll be a test to see what happens to the different staffs. And God says, "And it will come about that the rod of the man whom I choose will sprout. Thus I shall lessen from upon myself the grumblings of the sons of Israel who are grumbling against you." So God seems to suggest that this test is going to make the grumbling at least slow down, if not stop. Later, God says in verse 10, "But the Lord said to Moses, put back the rod of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumblings against me, so that they should not die." So two suggestions that the grumblings will either end or be diminished. And my suspicion is that at this point in time, Moses is thinking that's going to happen. So when we have grumbling breaking out again, Moses is mad. And I think that's part of what explains Moses' response on this particular occasion. It appears to me that there are slight indications that Moses has come to the place where he thinks he knows the mind of God on things. A few weeks back, Logan pointed out that in the incident where the plague came on the people, and Moses told Aaron, "Grab a censer and go stand out there between the living and the dead," without getting instructions from God or anything. He knew what needed to be done. He told Aaron to go do it. Aaron did it, and the plague stopped. And there's no censure of Moses in that situation. But it is interesting that, and that's what Logan was pointing out, it is interesting that Moses seemed to have known what God would have wanted to be done at that point in time. And I'm wondering if that's signaling us that Moses has reached that place where he thinks he knows the mind of God. Okay. And as I pointed out before, in this instance, Moses doesn't seem to identify with the people, and that's unusual. There's only one other time when he didn't. And in that other time, God didn't condemn him for it, but God treated it as though the cause of that was Moses' fatigue. Moses was just worn out, and that's why he didn't identify with the people. This time, he loses his patience and acts accordingly, and God does find fault with this. And in this instance then, he, despite what God had said, he takes the same action as he had taken in Exodus 17. He just doubles it rather than doing specifically what he was told to do. Okay, I will talk more about that at the end. Verse 14. From Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel has said, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, that our fathers went down to Egypt, and we stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, we heard our voice. He heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. Now behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We shall not pass through your field or through vineyard. We shall not even drink water from a well. We shall go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or left until we pass through your territory. Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, lest I come out with the sword against you. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, we shall go up by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I will pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else. But he said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory, so Israel turned away from him. Now when they set out from Kadesh, the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to Mount Hor. Edom, and you can look on your maps and your Bibles probably and find it. Edom is to the south of the Promised Land, to the south and a little bit to the east. The Edomites were the descendants of Esau, and as you'll recall from Genesis, Esau is an interesting character who was deceived by Jacob, taken advantage of. Jacob goes away for an extended period of time, thinking all the time that Esau's mad at him. But when Jacob comes back, Esau is very forgiving. It is a very impressive scene on the part of Esau in Genesis. So these are the descendants of Esau, distantly related to the Israelites. Archaeologists tell us that there doesn't seem to have been any civilization in the area of Edom at this particular time. There had been earlier, and there is later, but not at this particular time. Ashley says, although there are traces of civilization in this area from as early as 4000 BC and a high degree of it from about 2200 to 1900, there is a gap in cultural remains from about 1900 to 1300 BC. During these centuries, Bedouin seem to have been the major inhabitants of the land. One first hears of Edom in Egyptian texts from the late 13th and early 12th centuries. Bartlett has shown that the Edomites were an independent state of the organized type only in the 8th through the 6th centuries, much after the time of the conquest. So in all likelihood, the force that they're facing is a nomadic or semi-nomadic people, and it's that group of people that they ask permission to go through their land. They talk about their trek across the desert and include mention of the hardships that they've experienced in their appeal to the Edomites to let them pass through their land. They don't say where they're going, but they indicate that there's no hostile intent. They just want the rite of passage. The Edomites flatly reject their request. So the Israelites come back and ask again. And clarify, they'll stay on the highway. They won't go off the highway, and they'll pay for anything that they take. But the Edomites again refuse to let them go, and the Edomites put together an army that meets them at their border. So Israel goes around rather than challenge the Edomites. Verse 22. I read verse 22. I'll read it again. Now when they set out from Kadesh, the sons of Israel, the whole congregation came to Mount Hor. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron shall be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land which I have given to the sons of Israel, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. Take Aaron and his son Eleazar, and bring them up to Mount Hor, and strip Aaron of his garments, and put them on his son Eleazar. So Aaron will be gathered to his people and die there. So Moses did just as the Lord had commanded, and they went up to Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. And after Moses had stripped Aaron of his garments and put them on his son Eleazar, Aaron died there on the mountaintop. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain. And when all the congregation saw that Aaron had died, all the house of Israel wept for Aaron 30 days. So they come to Mount Hor. And at Mount Hor then, Moses and Aaron are told to go up to the top of the mountain. And Aaron is going to be gathered to his people. That is, he is going to die. And it says, for he shall not enter the land which I have given to the sons of Israel, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. So Aaron's supposed to go up. His son Eleazar is supposed to go up. And Aaron is stripped of his garments. So his priestly garb is taken off of him, and it is put on to Eleazar. So there's a passing of the baton. Eleazar is the successor to Aaron. And then Aaron dies there. All of this happens up on this mountain, and the whole congregation can see it. Again, it's unmediated. They can all see it directly. At Mount Sinai, Moses went up on Mount Sinai, but a cloud was covering the mountain. People couldn't see the interaction between Moses and God. Here they see exactly what's happening to Aaron. He is stripped of his garments, and that word stripped is, according to Ashley, that word is only used in instances where it is taken without authorization. Someone just removes the clothes. And we'll talk about that later. And the people mourned then his death for 30 days once he had died. Chapter 21. Verse 1. When the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atharim, then he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. So Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, if thou wilt indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord heard the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites. Then they utterly destroyed them and their cities, and thus the name of the place was called Hormah. So the Canaanites, they meet the Canaanites. They're meeting them at a place that corresponds to where they were defeated. The Israelites were defeated when they had tried to go into the promised land after God had told them not to. So this is approximately the same place. They're back there again. And the Canaanites, on this occasion, take the initiative, and they take some of the Israelites captive. So Israel appeals to God and says, if you will let us defeat them, then any plunder that we take, that will be devoted to you, God. And God responded to that, and they go up, and the Israelites defeat the Canaanites, and they destroy their cities at Hormah. Verse 4. Then they set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, And the people became impatient because of the journey. And the people spoke against God and Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food. So they're making their way up towards the Transjordan area from the south. They went around Edom. And it says the people became impatient because of the journey. So there's no crisis here. They're just tired. They're just impatient. And the people spoke against God and Moses. That's the first time we've seen that, where they spoke against God with God in the first spot. Usually they've been speaking against Moses or they've spoken against Aaron. But here it's they spoke against God and Moses. And they say, why'd you bring us out of Egypt? Again, that same complaint. We were better off in Egypt. We're just going to die here. And there's no food and there's no water and we loathe the food. There's no food, but we loathe the food. There is food. They've been provided with the manna throughout this time, and they're still being provided with manna, but they're obviously tired of it. It's boring. Verse 6, and the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many people of Israel died. So the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, because we have spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us. And Moses interceded for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard, and it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks upon at it, he shall live. And Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on the standard, and it came about that if a serpent bit any man, when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. So God acts immediately. There's no warning. There's no negotiations. God just sends these fiery serpents into their midst. And when these serpents bite someone, it kills them. And it says many died. Then we have the response of the people, and this is unique. It says, so the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned. That's the only time we get this response from the people. We have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and against Moses. And they ask for help. And they ask for Moses to pray for them. And Moses does so. This appears to be the most genuinely contrite that the Israelites have been on the whole trip through the wilderness. So God responds to this, and he does provide salvation. He instructs Moses to make a bronze serpent. That's the thing that's been biting them. Take a bronze serpent and put it up on a pole. And anyone who gets bitten, if they look at this, they will be saved. And so anyone who is bitten by the serpents, if they want to be saved, they can be saved. All they have to do is look at this serpent on the pole. A few comments about this incident. This is the most outrageously that they have ever behaved. They directly accuse God of doing this. There's really no reason for them to complain except they're tired of the food. God then responds immediately and harshly. And we haven't seen that before. And their response is to be more repentant than they've ever been before. So God responds on their behalf, and God provides salvation from these serpents. Okay. There's I'm just going to point something out. In 2 Kings 18:4, it says that Hezekiah broke in pieces the snake that had been made by Moses. Apparently, they had come to idolize, they had kept this snake, this bronze serpent, and they had come to idolize it, and it's hundreds of years later that it is destroyed by King Hezekiah, which I find very interesting. Okay, I am going to skip. I'm going to stop there, and I can read through the next section next week. I want very quickly to go through and talk about these three leaders. I want to talk about Miriam, Aaron, and Moses. Notice that here we are in what is apparently the 40th year, and God had said the whole generation, it will die. It will not go into the promised land. And we've got the leaders now dying. Miriam, what are we to think of Miriam? There's no fanfare in the text when she dies. It doesn't even talk about how long they mourned for her. It doesn't say at all. What do we know about her? We know that when Moses was put into a basket and put into the Nile, that she was the one that was in charge of watching over him. And she was the one who negotiated to have her mother nurse Moses for Pharaoh's daughter, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal thing for God to have orchestrated. But she played a role in that. The other place that we see Miriam is after they crossed the Red Sea. It points out that she was singing and dancing. Moses, we have the song of Moses, but then it says that she was singing and dancing and apparently singing the song of Moses. And in that context, it calls her a prophetess. Then the only other incident where we have Miriam mentioned is, if you'll recall, Miriam and Aaron both came and challenged Moses' authority. And she seemed to be the ringleader in that. And God rebuked her for doing it and punished her, gave her leprosy, and she had to go out of the camp for 7 days because of her uncleanness. I think that we are supposed to see Miriam in a positive light. In spite of the fact that she challenged Moses' authority, I think that we are supposed to see her as one of the leaders of Israel during this period of time, and one who carried out her duties, for the most part, responsibly. Aaron. He was stripped of his priestly garb and died before he went into the promised land. What do we know about him and what all of that he has done? Well, there are more things that could be talked about with respect to Aaron. If you'll recall, after Moses had talked to God in the burning bush and received his assignment, he left that area, and Aaron came out of Egypt to join Moses. And Moses filled him in on all that God had said. And God had told Moses that Aaron would be his helper in this assignment that had been given to Moses to take the Israelites out of Egypt. Then at Mount Sinai, we have the incident with the golden calf, in which Moses had gone up on the mountain on Mount Sinai, was gone for 40 days, and the people are thinking, we're stuck out here without any leadership, we're going to die, we've got to make a golden calf really quick, and they get Aaron to do it. It is interesting that in that incident, Aaron is not singled out for wrongdoing. He just couldn't stand up to the mob. Then we have the other incident where he and Miriam challenged Moses' authority. Again, he is not singled out for rebuke in that incident. And he is not punished. He played a secondary role in that affair. Then, as we've talked about, there are the challenges to Moses' or to Aaron's authority, and in those cases, we are to see Aaron as being unjustly attacked. And then again, at this incident at Meribah, Aaron isn't really mentioned in what he did, what role he played. It's Moses that we see acting and speaking. So again, Aaron is playing a secondary role, but he was punished for this. I think it's interesting that what the sense that you get of Aaron is that he is a very passive figure. He is not a real assertive, aggressive type of person. He just kind of goes along and is easily dragged along. But nevertheless, my sense is from the Old Testament in general that we are to see him in a positive light. For the most part, he is a positive figure. It's just that he is, there are a couple of instances where he is overpowered by others and dragged along into wrongdoing, and he goes along. Okay, now Moses. Moses hasn't died yet. Moses isn't going to die till the end of Deuteronomy, so we can look back at his whole life when we get to the end of Deuteronomy. But I want to answer the question that always comes to my mind and comes to minds of others when you get to this passage. Why does such a noble and faithful person get punished so severely for just one little mess up? Does it not seem that way? First of all, Moses is an exemplary person. I think that has to be the case. It is not true that he gets punished severely for what he does. His eternal destiny is intact. He isn't damned to hell for what he's done. He is just told that he will not lead the people into the promised land. And in the bigger picture of things, that's not a big deal. And we need to recognize that God is not averse to subjecting people to hardship and disappointment. He does that a lot. That is the testing that is at the heart of human existence in this life, is that hardship and disappointment. You know, that's what Numbers is about, is the hardship and disappointment as the people are working their way through the wilderness. And God subjected them to that. God did not just wait for Moses to make one little mistake and then pounce. What Moses did was a significant act of disobedience. And God is just, and he does not overlook evil. He doesn't overlook disobedience. What Moses did messed up God's symbolism, if I'm right. Moses did mess up the symbolism that was built into that little scene. This incident just exposed a latent flaw in Moses. I don't think that we're to see this as a one and only event, but rather it is indicative of something that is actually a part of Moses' life. And the story demanded it. One of the reasons that this happens to Moses is the story demanded it. I've used this illustration before, so forgive me if you remember it. But this comes from J.K. Rowling. My son Noah was telling me about this. She was writing a section of one of the books, and she came out of her study, and she was just weeping uncontrollably. And her husband says, "What's going on?" And she said, "A certain character, I won't tell you his name because I'll spoil it for you. But one of the characters died, and it was very sad for her because it was a character that she was fond of. And her husband said, well, why don't you have him not die? And she said, because the story demands it. And I love that. I love that. That illustration, because it fits so well with what God is doing. All of history is God telling a story, essentially. It is a very complex story, and a lot of things happen. But it's essentially a story, and it's a story that tells us who He is and what He's up to. And it's a story that I think we're going to have eternity to look back on and reflect on and figure out, well, why did this happen? Why did this happen? Oh, I see why those things happened. Because they highlight this particular aspect of who God is. We're going through Ezekiel in a group, and the thing that this phrase that keeps coming up is, and then they will know that I am God. That in the end, we're going to know that God was the one who was behind all of this story, and that all of this story, in one way or another, is about Him. And if that's the case, there are certain things that have to happen in the story. To communicate what God wants it to communicate, there are certain things that have to happen. And there are lots of things that have to happen. And I think one of the things that had to happen is Moses had to show himself to be a sinner. Moses had to show himself to also be a rebel, just like the Israelites, like all of the other Israelites. And that's what has to happen here right at the end of the time that they're in the wilderness, is even the leadership, they are rebels, just like all of the other Israelites. Ashley says, here Moses and Aaron succumb to the same sin. They have refused by their actions to rely on God to quench His people's thirst without their aid, in spite of all that He has done. They therefore disobeyed what God had commanded, culminating with Moses' striking the rock twice. As the people had refused to rely on Yahweh in their first sojourn at Kadesh and were condemned to die outside the land of promise, so here in the second sojourn there, many years later, the leaders make the same mistake and are sentenced to the same fate. So in the end, what we see in Numbers is they're all, to one degree or another, they're all rebels, and all of them are going to have to die before the Israelites go into the promised land. Okay, there's a little bit of time. There are lots of things we could talk about. But there's a little bit of time. We'll see what we can do.
Thanks, David. One of the things that you didn't mention, and I was curious about in terms of comparing and contrasting the Exodus 17 account to the Numbers account, is the Exodus 17 account has God saying that He's going to stand before the assembly on the rock when Moses strikes it. Mm-hmm. And there's no mention of that. Is that assumed? And what do you think he mean? What does it mean? Is there significance to that?
Let me take the last part of that question first. Is there a significance? I think absolutely there is. I don't know what it is. And I think in both of these, there pictures are being created. And that's what I've talked about this. It seems to me that what's happening in Exodus and Numbers in particular is God is creating these pictures that can be drawn upon in later times to help us to understand various theological concepts for the most part. But it's, I am not far enough along yet to be able to understand what exactly these pictures are depicting. And part of my problem is I'm convinced one has to get it pretty accurate as to what God is doing. It is really easy to come up with an explanation that would take you over here and another explanation that would take you over here theologically, but they can't both be true. And the question is, what is this little picture depicting? And that's what I'm having difficulty nailing down. But that it's depicting something, that there's symbolism built into both the Exodus 17 account and Numbers 20, I am quite certain of that. I'm just hoping as I get more background and get a little bit more clarity, I'll be able to figure out what exactly they are depicting.
Do you think in the Exodus 17 account, it would have been clear to at least the elders who were around that there's some presence of some visible presence there, or is just God telling Moses, I'm there on the rock. No one else knows that I'm there on the rock, but you know I'm there on the rock. I don't know,
but in other instances in Numbers where God has been present, there has been some manifestation of it such that that was clear. I would assume that the same is true here, but I'm just going on that basis.
All right. Thanks, David. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. In verse 10
of
Numbers 20, when Moses says, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" If I caught what you said, you're taking the "we" as meaning Moses saying that with God.
Yeah.
I think, could not the "we" be Moses and Aaron?
It could be.
Because the people grumbled against Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron were supposed to take the congregation out. Moses and Aaron did take the congregation out. And it seems like it's most likely that the "we" is referring to Moses and Aaron, which would show more of what Aaron's sin was too. It's all like they were perhaps trying to justify themselves before the people, maybe not realizing, but basically dishonoring God by doing that. And I'm even wondering, that idea of why he struck twice instead of once. I'm wondering if the striking twice is once for Moses and once for Aaron.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And that was their sin, that they dishonored God, because they were, in the past, God had justified them before the people. But it was almost like they were justifying themselves before the people now.
Yeah.
Something like that.
That's possible. That's possible.
If this is near the end of the 40 years, when it talks about the people grumbling, what's your sense for the demographic? Is this the prior generation that are waiting to die in the wilderness before the people moves into the land? Or are we starting to hear the voice of the next generation?
My suspicion is that when it says the people grumbled, it's talking about people of influence. And so I'm thinking this is primarily the older generation. But I don't think that means that the younger generation coming along doesn't have the same flaws, because we'll see as we progress, they have some of the same tendencies. But I just think that the text is probably suggesting that it's that same generation that is continuing to grumble. They're leading that. But there should be, a lot of those people should be dying off at this point. We shouldn't have a whole lot of them left. I just assume that they're in positions of leadership.
So if we are supposed to see signs of contrition in the incident with the snakes, are you more inclined to take that as the previous generation is finally making a little progress before they die, rather than seeing it as the next generation is maybe it's sinking in a little better for them than it did for their parents?
I think it is a strange kind of progress that we're seeing. That on the one hand, they're more overtly rebellious, but on the other hand, it seems like they're quicker to recognize what they're doing. And if that's true, that's encouraging.
Thanks.
When God tells Moses and Aaron what they've done wrong, he says, because you didn't believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people. And then he tells them their punishment. Mm-hmm. What does God mean when he says they didn't uphold him as holy in the eyes of the people?
I think what it means is to uphold God as holy is to recognize his set-apartness and therefore to recognize his purity and his authority. So what they did is they didn't take him entirely seriously. They weren't entirely obedient to him.
So is it's another way of saying you disobeyed?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.